Members, since we do have a quorum, I will call the meeting to order and would ask for a motion on the minutes before us.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the minutes.
Thank you. Discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. We'll hang on here for a second and we'll get on to the first bill here when the chairman comes down.
Let's see, we'll hear the chair will move House File 608. And with us today, we have Mr. Gary Bocek, and you can present my bill and what it's all about, where it came from, and what it's doing here. Thank you, and welcome to the committee. Just state your name and who you represent for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Sergeant at Arms. Mr. Hackbarth, Gary Bocek, I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Conservation Federation. Last year, I was in front of you with a $2 million funding bill for the shooting ranges out of game and fish funds. We were successful, and DNR, of course, as you probably know, runs that grant program, and they're here to answer any technical questions, I believe. But we have got, in the first round of that $2 million that was appropriated by the legislature last year, $400,000 was appropriated in the first round of grants to cities like, and I printed them out here, Annandale and a number of cities that you will recognize from your districts are close by. Becker, Detroit Lakes, Belgrade, Buffalo, Byron, Canby, Kimball, on and on. But these shooting range grant money go to shooting ranges, and with the expectation that they improve and enhance and expand their facilities for one basic reason, and that is to allow the high school shooting league to get more exposure and add teams and add numbers to their teams. I think you're probably most all familiar with high school clay target shooting clubs and teams. I sat in yesterday on Commissioner Landwehr's confirmation hearing in the Senate, and he mentioned this as one of the success stories of his agency, and we're very proud to be a part of that. I believe he mentioned there are 6,000 high school kids that were shooting, and I expect 9,000 this year. It's that kind of phenomenal exponential growth, and we need to work a little bit on the supply side. We need to make more ranges bigger and better and more accessible so these high school kids can use as teams. And we're talking about young men and young women. In fact, the young women are better shooters, as we all know, than the young guys. But no one's ever been killed. They get gun safety. This is a shotgun, as you know. This is not a rifle. This is not a handgun. These are shotguns. So very safe, very secure. I've got just one handout. It's a resolution that we passed, Conservation Federation, last September, and it just backs up our bill. And as I say, we were successful last year at $2 million, and we're asking for $5 this year. DNR informs us that the governor put in $500,000 each year, so he's got $1 million in his budget bill, and we're asking for $5. So we hope we can reach some agreement down the road. Game and Fish Fund, again, not general fund. We're not here to play that game. So that's kind of where we're at. It's a lot of my members are sportsmen's clubs. A lot of them either have their own shooting ranges or participate locally. And very fortunate to have with me today John Nelson, who's the vice president of the Minnesota State High School Clay Target League. And he's just going to give you a couple of statistics and urge you to support this bill as well.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Thank you. My name is John Nelson. I'm vice president of the Minnesota State High School Clay Target League. And the story goes back really to 2000. I'll try to take you through 14 years really quick. As Jim Sable retired at his local gun club in Plymouth Gun Club, after retiring at the age of tender age of 60, Jim noticed that he was the youngest one at his gun club and figured out that there seemed to be a problem here. And seeing as how many people were around the table drinking coffee more than trap shooting. One of the challenges that Jim was facing yet was to reduce that average age at his gun club, which was the age of 56. And to do that, he thought the best place to get that is with kids. And so Jim worked with a local church and a local group in putting together a small team that competed against a couple other teams and did that until about 2008. In 2008, we found some more interest from some other schools, and we actually formed the Minnesota State High School Clay Target League. By forming this organization, we worked closely with Dave Stead, who's the executive director of the Minnesota State High School League, which is a state high school athletic association. And Dave provided us some terrific insights to start a program. He also cautioned us that we needed to have the utmost patience in trying to get a varsity sport started in high schools, primarily because it took lacrosse 7 years to become a varsity sport. Obviously, saying kids, guns, and schools in the same sentence, we expected a few more years for that to take. But when we started that league, our teams doubled every year in the number of kids. We started with 30 kids in our first year in 2008, and we doubled in for the first five consecutive years. As Mr. Botzek mentioned, last year we had 6,100 kids in our program, and these are boys and girls in adaptive sport. We are the only co-ed and adaptive sport in high school. So kids in wheelchairs compete right alongside boys and girls in grades 6 through 12. We require that all kids have a firearm safety certification that comes from the DNR. And since that time, we've had an outstanding track record with zero reported injuries, and in addition to that is no violations of gun safe violations at school. Our program continues to grow. So even just last year with 6,100 kids participating in the program, we expect almost 9,000 kids to be participating not only this spring, but we also run a fall program too. So that means we'll have over 12,000 participants in our program. Even with just about the 9,000 kids on the Minnesota State High School League participant activity list, where they have 45 activities that are listed, shooting sports has become a top 10 activity in the state. In fact, we are bigger than boys high school hockey. So boys high school hockey in Minnesota started in 1930. We've been going for 6 years, and we've already passed them. The only thing that's holding us back is gun club capacity. Currently, we have about 150 trap shooting facilities in the state that are hosting teams. That's 149 more than what we had just 6 years ago. In addition to that, last year we estimated that we turned away about 1,800 kids, and every year we do a survey to the coaches to find out is what's the major component in them in restricting their teams the number of kids participating. The number one reason is facilities, is trap fields. And so the only way that we can maintain our growth in moving forward is to increase capacity at gun clubs. Obviously, as Mr. Botzek had mentioned earlier too, when gun clubs were closing down years ago and struggled to stay open, we're working really hard and trying to open those back up. And so with the support that's happening, we've really just started to achieve our goal in saving gun clubs, which was our goal around that started at a kitchen table in 2001. And we certainly would appreciate that support moving forward.
Okay. Questions for Mr. Botzek or Mr. Nelson at this point? We've got a couple other testifiers in the audience that would like to speak. Okay, seeing none, would Mr. Larry Rogers come forward? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you're representing for the record.
Yes, Mr. Chair. My name is Larry Rogers. I'm currently the president of Minnesota Weapons Collectors Association. We're the largest and the oldest weapons collecting association in the state of Minnesota. We've been around for over 60 years now. Our primary focus for our organization is promoting the art of weapons collections and the shooting sports. We do a lot of our funding for the youth shooting goes towards the trap shooting leagues. The requests have been coming at us fast and furious. We aren't able to keep up with them, but obviously the need and the want is there. And like it was said earlier, the holdup is the availability of the shooting facilities. The funding and the just the mere presence of them. So anything that would help alleviate that and allow people who are interested participating to participate, we are in total support of as an organization and myself personally.
Thank you. Questions, members? Thank you for your testimony. Mr. Drake Jackson. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Drake Jackson, board member of the Minnesota Outdoor Heritage Alliance. And we just wanted to be here today to also say we've supported the shooter youths for as long as they've been going, and that we would like to see more support given to them so that all that want to participate can with facilities that they can do it.
Very good. Questions for members? Thank you very much for your testimony. Anyone from the audience that would like to speak for or against the bill? Okay, seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 608 be re-referred to the Committee on Environment, Natural Resources, Policy, and Finance Committee. All in favor of that motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, motion prevails. The bill is passed. Thank you, everyone that testified. Thank you, Mr. Botic. Mr. Nelson, thank you. Okay, Representative Fabian. The chair will move House File 302 for possible inclusion. Representative Fabian, would you like to speak to both your bills at the same time as long as, okay. The chair will also move House File 691 for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Appreciate the opportunity to be here to discuss House File 302 and 691. Full disclosure, I do not own a muzzleloader. I am over 60. Well, I am 60, not over, but so this isn't something that I'm caring for myself. I've had many, many conversations with many of my constituents over the last 4 years that I've been in the legislature. There's a tremendous number of avid muzzleloader hunters in my area who have repeatedly asked me to try to get this through the legislative process. So I'd appreciate your support on this as we move it through. I am a firearms enthusiast. Had a conversation with one of the gentlemen earlier today. And for me, what this bill is about is it's about recruitment, it's about retention, and it's about clean kill. A few years ago, I detached and tore my retina on my shooting eye, and if I did own a muzzleloader, I would be qualified for the no magnification scope. But even at that, oftentimes when you look through the sights on a long gun, it's difficult sometimes to distinguish things that are there. So I realize that that's an option. Basically what House File 302 does is it just takes the language that's currently in statute that allows for a visually impaired hunter to use a scope on their muzzleloader and just substitutes in the language that allows for a person to place a scope on their muzzleloader to use it for taking deer. What House File 691 does is it takes the us old people in the room, those who are over the 60 or over, and allows them to use a scope on a muzzleloader with magnification capabilities. So if you have the bill in front of you, you might be a little confused on that on the front page on 1.9 and 1.10, where it talks about a person who is under the age of 60. That just refers to what we currently can do. So it puts that language there and then makes the correction on the second page, lines 2.12 and 2.14. So with that, Mr. Chair, if you don't have any objections, I'd like to introduce Becca Kent and Rick Stang, who are here to testify on behalf of the bill.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
My name is Becca Kent. I work for MDHA, but I am representing myself as a hunter.
Okay, please proceed.
All right. I'm proud to be a muzzleloader hunter, and I'm proud to go out hunting with a muzzleloader because there's a true art behind it, and it's really enjoyable. I first started out muzzleloader hunting with my father, and I started muzzleloader hunting because I was hunting in an area where it was shotgun only. So we started out with, during firearm season, hunting with muzzleloaders with scopes on them because it's fun. It's really something to to go through the process and to load the powder and to put in the sabots and so forth. But it's something to use a scope on a muzzleloader. It's more ethical. It's more humane. There's a difference when you're trap shooting or target shooting versus hunting. And it allows for more ethical shots when you're hunting and so forth. Just like bow hunting, when it first came about, you first only used recurves, and then it came about that you could use compound bows. At first it was scary, you know, to have the change, but the change allowed for ethical and more humane shots and better accuracy and so forth. But it also helped the sport grow, which is something that I think muzzleloading needs, is they need a change in order to help the sport grow. And I think it would be appealing to younger people because you have the accuracy involved. By having a scope on there, you feel more confident versus using an iron sight and so forth. And it is adapting to society as we change by having better technology. You know, we're 2015. We might as well be using the best equipment that we can when we're hunting. And scopes is one of those components as well. If you were to allow scopes on muzzleloaders, it wouldn't enforce that you would have to use a scope on a muzzleloader. It would allow it for an option, and that's what I think is important. As a hunter, it's nice to have options in order to hunt in different methods. There's an opportunity to hunt the traditional way, and that's A-OK, but there's also a great opportunity to grow the sport by having an option and giving life to muzzleloading, which right now it's not really growing. It's, you know, it's an opportunity to give life to a sport, and it's something that I feel important about, and it would be a good opportunity to move forward. So, thank you.
Thank you. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Good afternoon. My name is Rick
Stang.
Please
speak into the microphone.
Sorry. Good afternoon. My name is Rick Stang. I am also a member of the MDHA, Minnesota Deer Hunters Association, but I am representing myself as a long-term muzzleloading hunter. I've been hunting now with muzzleloader for 22 years, I believe. I'm also a rifle hunter. I'm also a bow hunter. I'm representing the old guys. As Representative Fabian said, I am over 60 years old, just turned 60 in December. I've been using the one power, no magnification scope, as allowed for by Minnesota law for about the last 5 years now, because my eyesight is not what it was when I was 25, 30 years old. I do have a difficulty in lining up the front and rear open sights, maintaining a target on the game that I'm trying to shoot, and there have been quite a few shots in the last couple of years, even with the one-power scope, that I've passed on simply because I didn't feel comfortable in a quick, humane kill, and out of respect for the animal, I didn't take the shot. I have a lot of opportunities to shoot deer. I don't need to shoot a deer, but when I do, I want to make sure that out of respect for the animal, it's a quick, humane shot, and that animal goes down, doesn't suffer. With old eyes, it makes it a little tough to be sure of that shot. It hasn't prohibited me from buying a muzzleloader license. I bought a muzzleloader license and haven't taken a deer for 3 years with a muzzleloader. And that's fine. I don't have a problem with that. Helping donate money to the DNR and all of the good things that comes with those license fees, don't have a problem with that either. But as Becca was saying, I believe it will open up more opportunity. I believe it will aid in recruitment. There will be more licenses sold from a monetary standpoint. Currently, there are 40 states that will allow any use of optics on muzzleloaders. We are one of six states that allows use of optics with permits. Once again, you go to an optometrist, they look and say, yes, your eyes are old, they don't work the way they used to. We'll give you a note that says it's fine, and I get a permit from the DNR. There are five states that do not allow any use of optics on muzzleloaders. And currently, out of those five states, there are four that have already introduced bills to allow optics on muzzleloaders. The other thing that I would like to see for people who don't choose to use optics is an archaic firearms season strictly for people who want to use flintlock or percussion cap muzzleloaders with open iron sights. That would also aid in recruitment. There are a lot of hunters out there, I believe. I won't say a lot, but there are a group of hunters out there that believe in the old way of hunting deer. If they had their preference, they'd be out there in their buckskins with their powder horns, and that's great. I think that's wonderful. And they don't have their own season right now. I'd go buy another license. That would be four licenses that I would purchase every year, and I would go out and, darn, I'd have to buy another gun. So I'd really would like to see the laws changed to allow for use of magnifying scopes on muzzleloaders. I believe it helps with the taking of deer, the humane taking of deer. I believe it helps in recruitment, and it'll sell more licenses. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Representative Fabian, should we discuss your other bill as well before we take any questions?
Sure. That'd be fine with me.
House 691.
Yep, and I talked about that earlier, how on the first page it may seem a little confusing because we've got the under 60 there, but that just has to do with the law that currently, the way that it is, and so the correction is made to get to where I want the bill on page 2, lines 2.12 and 2.14. So
I thought maybe your testifiers might want to add something about that particular bill.
If they want to, and again, like I said, full disclosure, I don't own a muzzle loader, so it doesn't really impact me. The reality is it would be kind of fun, and under my current situation, I might buy an extra license. So if you guys have anything to say about the over 60, go ahead.
Ms. Kent, did you have any other comments on the next bill?
For the age of, yes, for over 60, I travel a lot. I talk to a lot of hunters. I like talking to a lot of people about hunting, something I'm passionate about. And I know with individuals that are over 60, I think it would benefit the sport and give life to another group of individuals that want to start up with muzzleloading because they're going to be more comfortable and more confident in their shooting. And it could be an opportunity for growth again. When you're 60 years old, I'm not at that age yet, but you know, your eyesight is something that you are concerned about, and iron sights versus over, you know, with scopes, I think it would increase everybody's comfortability going out in the woods if they knew that they could use a scope versus the iron sights for that age group. Thank you.
Mr. Stang, did you have any additional comments on the next bill, House File 691?
Other than to reiterate what I've already said, I am over 60. I do use a one-power non-magnifying scope on my muzzleloader, and I would prefer to be able to use a magnifying scope. It gives you a much bigger objective lens. You can actually see through it a lot better than you can a one-power magnifying scope, not because it magnifies, simply because it's actually a larger aperture and gives you better eyesight. And once again, the point is a quick, humane kill. Just because you have a scope on a muzzleloader doesn't mean you're going to shoot more deer with a muzzleloader. It doesn't work that way. Anyone who's a muzzleloader hunter understands what a proper shot with a muzzleloader and what the limitations of a muzzleloader are. It just makes sure that if you have good optics on that muzzleloader, that you'll take the correct shot, a humane shot, put that animal down, don't let it suffer.
Well, Mr. Stang, I would have to argue that even with a rifle with a high-powered scope on it, you still have to make that decision whether it's going to be a humane kill or not. Members, we'll take questions before we call on other testifiers from the audience. Any questions? Representative Cornyn.
Mr. Chair, members, I don't want to rail on the bill here, Representative Fabian, but I've always been against it. I think when I was a lobbyist before I was come up here as the legislator, it was before us then, but just several points, especially the DNR did say, I doubt if enforcement, I won't put words in their mouth, but has any objection, but why should they? I mean, they just enforce the law. But wildlife did tell us once that they thought it would increase the deer take, and now with we're talking about we don't have enough deer in the herd right now in a lot of places. I just worry about the increase. As far as the humane kill, we use rifles for years and still do. I run across 30-30s and 30-06s and 270s with open sights. And the modern inline muzzleloader, I've hunted with that. I started out with the cap lock, the Hawken 50s. And years ago, I've shot bear and deer and everything else with it over the years. And I'm a bow hunter, too. But It is highly accurate. The muzzleloaders now with the ramp front sight and the green and the red and fluorescent sights, you can easily shoot over 100 yards with the effective kills each time. And it requires the same amount of expertise as any other open-sighted rifle would. And with the current inline muzzleloaders, you're shooting almost the velocity of a 30-30 rifle, so it's very comparable. And you're shooting copper-jacketed hollow-point bullets just like you can with a rifle. So usually in other states, the way this starts out is it starts out as a handicapped hunt or something, or a veteran's hunt, and then the eye is factored in, and it kind of croaches up. And what I worry about is the muzzleloaders brought this to us years ago were the primitive type folks, and they brought this season to us, and it's a 16-day season, and I really worry about the DNR managing the season if we start to take too many deer by reducing the days. I like the long 16-day deer season right now. I even shoot with a scope muzzleloader, and what people might not know is you can shoot with a scope muzzleloader right now if you want to use a scope during the whole deer season, rifle season, so you've got opportunity to do that. And so I just worry about not so much having to be primitive, but increasing the numbers so much out there and then taking more deer. It is a really effective weapon right now, and one that I've always thought should be reserved for the 16-day more primitive hunt. And I see your points, and I see what you're getting at. As far as recruitment, I don't think it would bring one new hunter in. I don't think a hunter is sitting at home that doesn't hunt with a rifle or a shotgun or a bow just because you throw an inline muzzleloader in there that will bring a new hunter out in recruitment. You probably will sell more licenses and good for revenue. I admit that, but I don't think it would recruit anymore. That's just my spin on it that I've always had, and I don't think it's the end of the world, but it's just the concerns that I have. So.
Any other questions, members?
Representative Mr. Chairman, could I address that?
Okay.
Is that allowed? I'm sorry.
Yep, sure, Mr. Tang.
As far as taking more deer, in the state of Minnesota, we're allowed to take one deer, unless you're hunting in the metro area. Now, this year, I bought three licenses and didn't take a deer. And I'm perfectly fine with that. So when you say it's going to take more deer, a person's still only allowed to take one deer unless it is in an intensive harvest area. Is that correct?
Yeah, what I was referring to is take more deer during the muzzleloader season. Right now we plan on taking a certain amount, but you're going to increase your effectiveness to take more deer during the muzzleloader season. So that's why I worry about they plan on the number of deer taken each season, and I just worry about bringing the numbers up in the muzzleloader season. So the way the DNR decides to adjust that is reduce the days down and shorten it to a 7 or 5 or 3 day season to make up for the increased take because of the effectiveness of the scope. And so that and other things are just a little uncomfortable with it.
Representative Mehta.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Fabian, I know we've had the conversation. I don't support this version, but after seeing the next bill we'll be discussing, you can count on my vote for that one.
Representative Fabian?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Metza, we're kind of discussing both at the same time. So, and if I may, Mr. Chair.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, to Representative Cornish, and I appreciate the primitive hunt thing. In fact, I'd love to see Representative Anzels in buckskins and a loincloth. I think that would.
Me too.
Oh, boy.
Oh, boy.
You're better off just letting her lay.
With regards to the game wardens and so forth, a couple of winters ago, I was up in Brainerd, and we were on the MinUSA snowmobile ride, and the game wardens and I were kind of hanging out and talking about where we could escape with the snowmobiles and break away from the group and go riding. But in part of the conversation, I asked them about the scopes on muzzleloaders. And in that circle, all of those guys, and I think there was five of them, had no trouble with using the scopes on muzzleloaders. And I asked them specifically, when you're out and about and you're checking on hunters during the muzzleloader season, how many of the primitive rifles do you see today? And out of five guys in the past couple of years, they hadn't seen a half a dozen of them. So for me, you know, looking at this from the outside, not being a muzzleloader hunter, I certainly respect the idea of the primitive hunt and all that sort of stuff, but the reality is that that's really not what's happening nowadays, and You know, as Ms. Kent said here a little while ago, you know, we used to hunt with a longbow, and then we went to a recurve, and then we went to compound bows, and you couldn't use a release, and you couldn't use, and all of this stuff is evolving. And I don't know that we're going to take that many more deer. I don't know if DNR has a position on this. I haven't really spoken very much to them. They're concerned about the increased take. I just think it's an issue whose time has come for me personally. And I appreciate your support.
Additional questions?
If I could make one more comment, I hate to hog things. Thank you. With addressing your concern about no more recruitment, I belong to a firearm safety instruction group, and we push through roughly 300 students a year in the North Metro area. And part of our range day is to introduce kids to muzzleloaders and give them the opportunity to shoot muzzleloaders. By far and away, we usually have 4 muzzleloaders lined up, and the line behind the one with the one power scope on it is always about at least twice as long as any other. So it does get youth interested in a different type of shooting sport that maybe they haven't been exposed to before. Thank you.
Very good. We have Mr. Rogers in the audience that would like to speak to this issue as well. Anyone else in the audience that would like to speak for or against the bill? Mr. Rogers, you can come forward, and then we'll ask again if anybody wants to speak. Welcome to the committee again, and please state your name and who you represent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Larry Rogers. Again, I'm president of the Minnesota Weapons Collectors Association. I myself am not a muzzle loader shooter, but we do have several members within our organization that are. And in posing the question to them, there are some that talked about the purist aspect of the sport, but at the same time had no objection to the scopes. Personally, I believe it'll add to the safety and the overall enjoyment of the sport. So in that regard, we stand in support of it.
Thank you. Questions for? Okay, seeing none, thank you. Anyone else in the audience that would like to speak for either bill? House File 302 or House File 691. Oh, okay. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, DNR. On both bills, this has been a perennial subject that we've been having at the legislature. We've testified in the past that it's not a biological issue at all. We are managing the deer herd. You have needed an antlerless permit in most parts, if not all parts of the state, to take a antlerless deer in the muzzleloader season right now. So it's really a social issue. Last year, the legislature allowed crossbows for people 60 and over. We saw a significant decrease in the applications that we had to process for those people. So if we were to go to 60 years and older, it would probably be a likewise reduction in the workload on that end of it. As far as the magnification, you know, if this issue does move forward, a scope is a scope is a scope. Don't make our officers become weapon optic experts, right? Trying to look at these scopes and determine what magnification they are and things like that. So the department could live with scopes on muzzleloaders. We've been managing the deer herd based on the population desires, not on the techniques of harvest. So I do understand the need for older people. It may get more people, keep more people in the field longer with the muzzleloader perhaps, but as Representative Corner said, you can use a muzzleloader with the scope on it now during the rifle or the shotgun season. So we're basically neutral on the issue. It won't impact the deer harvest either way, our population method. So.
Questions for Mr. Meyer? Commissioner Meyer? Thank you for you. Oh, Representative Lloyd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. Meyer. So if, and I'm not a muzzle loader hunter, and I'm well over 60, that doesn't count either way. But so if you got a citizen out there that wants to use a muzzle loader to hunt during a regular deer season and a scope, then he or she outfits a rifle in that manner, hunts, and they don't get a deer. They've got a license for the primitive hunt, so then they take the they take the scope off, or they've got another weapon. Is that how it works? So you have to modify, if you're a one-gun person, you got to modify the gun before you go to the next season?
Mr. Meyer. Chairman, Representative Luke, yes, I put a scope on my muzzle loader this year to hunt in the shotgun season, as one of the testifiers spoke of. If I wanted to hunt in the muzzle loader season, I would have had to take that scope off and take off the bases, because I couldn't see without the sights with the bases on there, and put those back on there, and then again next season put the bases back on, put my scope back on, resight it. So for people that have one firearm, that would be a problem for them.
I guess a follow-up, if I could, Mr. Chair. And so also you have a special process and permitting system for those that have to go to an optometrist that would use the single magnifying type optical. And so you really do put staff time and got to run around with that extra piece of paper. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, correct.
I guess just as a general comment, I think we ought to get out of the way of this and end the need for those kind of special permits. And, you know, if a guy or gal needs to own two weapons, that's fine. But I think we're really down in the weeds here trying to dictate whether you can or can't use a scope on a muzzle loader any more than, you know, we're going to go after fish finders. You name it. Our spotting scope's okay. I mean, come on. Let's get out of the way of the people that want to hunt. That's my position on this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Anyone else in the audience that would like to speak for or against these bills? Seeing none, the chair will renew his motion that we will hold these bills over, House File 302 and House File 691, for possible inclusion. Thank you for your testimony, Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate the opportunity.
Representative Lewick. Or, I'm sorry, Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will move House File 767 for possible inclusion into the omnibus bill.
Representative Lewick moves House, or Representative Lucero moves House File 767 for possible inclusion. Please proceed with your explanation of your bill.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I have some bad news, and that is you are the second committee. And the first committee I testified at got nice big donuts about the size of two fists, so unfortunately you don't get that.
I guess you don't want your bill passed.
So House File 767 is a veterans firearms bill, and what it does is exempt veterans from firearm safety, the firearm safety certificate for hunting permits. I have several testifiers, and I'll pass it on.
Very good. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent.
State Representative Bob Detmer. And I've been asked to come and just talk about my experiences in the military and to maybe to give the committee, Mr. Chair, a little example of what goes on in the military in terms of weapons. We call them weapons, not firearms. Weapons training in the military. First of all, how many here have served in the military? Okay, so we have people here that have served in the military. Well, number one, when you go to basic training, you have a drill sergeant that's assigned to you, and they put you on the firing line. First of all, you have safety training with your weapons. One thing you learn right away, you don't call it a gun, you call it a weapon. And you spend time before you even get on the range and with the training and with the safety. You learn how to take your weapon apart, put it back together, basically in your sleep. And many times you do sleep with it, and you carry it with you wherever you go. When you arrive to the range, first of all, you go through some safety training, and you look down the range. You got a 50-yard target. You got a 300-meter target, and they're all pop-up targets, the modern targets that we have now in the weapon ranges, and they're all controlled by a computer. And the weapons that most of us train on is the M16. I trained on the M16A1 and A2, and also the 9mm. As an officer, you also fired a 9mm hand weapon. The range. When you're on the range, you have a range patrol there. You have a tower, a person in the tower who controls the environment. You have a coach, another soldier that's with you on the range that watches you as you go through the procedures, setting up your firing station. You get about 20 to 40 soldiers on the line at the same time, all firing downrange. And you have this during your annual training, and now when you're with your unit, and I spent 25 years in the reserve component, and during annual training you have your range, your firing ranges, and also mostly twice a year that you qualify. Now when you qualify, you get basically 40 rounds, and with your qualification you get a different rank in terms of your qualification, and it goes for you also earn promotion points through qualification. If you're going to get deployed, mobilized and deployed, you have to qualify before they will send you overseas. And there's some interesting ways that different people qualified that we made sure that they qualified. All MOSs, regardless if you're regardless what MOS that you serve in your military occupational specialty, you will learn weapon safety and you will qualify. So with that, I think what we're trying to do here with the House File 767 is good, because you do get a lot of training, you get a lot of time on the range when you are serving, and I think under the current law, there is exemption only those who are on active duty, and we all know now with the drawdown and active duty component with the reserve component and your National Guard are utilized more and more in your mobilizations and deployments. So I support this bill.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. My name is Ralph Donay. I'm chairman of the United Veterans Legislative Council of Minnesota. I kind of predate Representative Detmer as far as shooting on the range. We had a 100, 300, and 500 meter range, but I was in the Marine Corps for 30 years, so we're a little bit different. But I chime in with him. Every time you go on a deployment or went anywhere and left your home base, you had to be familiar with the weapons that you were going to be taking with you. Personally, I've fired 45s, 38s, 9 millimeters, M60s, AR-16s, M14s, M1s, I think I said M60s. There's just a host of weaponry that you come in contact with. Everyone in the Marine Corps is a basic rifleman. That's the first thing they tell you, is you're a basic rifleman. And then whatever specialty you go beyond that is what your job is while you're in the service. And all the services do that, I believe. I even remember the sailors shooting. I used to tease them. They shot a 22 at a paper target. But it was still a range, and they had to shoot the weapon. And it wasn't like you just grab a gun and go shoot. It doesn't work that way. So anything that we can do to make Minnesota more friendly for our veterans, to help them out, to get them out there, and as he stated, I don't know if you are aware of the drawdowns and how many people are being pushed out of the military and coming back. I was working at Headquarters Marine Corps when we removed 400,000 people from the military. So there was a considerable amount of people that had to come back. And I think we'd like to have them back in Minnesota, joining the rest of us with hunting. I hunt up north in Embarrass, Minnesota, where it's really cold. Thank you. If there's any further questions, when it's 40 degrees or 20 below here, they whine. I tell them you need to go up north. Thank you, sir.
Representative Cornish, question.
For the author, it's a great bill. I just worry about how it's written here. I would still think you would just want to get issued a certificate anyway, because we require the certificate, like in Colorado or Western states, to buy a license out there. And here, I agree, you don't have the way summary is written up here is it says you don't have to obtain one. I would rather see you show your proof and then have them issue you one, because you're going to need it in the Western states to buy a license, even though you don't here. So I wondered if you could address that, or am I wrong on that? I know a lot of people need their certificate to hunt out west, so I would rather see it issue you one, not have to pay for it if you prove your training is maybe the researcher can shed some light on that. But the last I knew, you needed one in most states out west. You need the certificate to buy a license.
Taylor?
Mr. Chair, members, as I understand it, it would probably cause some issues with other states because you would be required to have one, and whether or not they would recognize.
We can easily amend that, though, Mr. Chair, by just saying that they would issue one upon proof of military training. So.
Representative Lucero?
Mr. Chair, I'm definitely amenable to that.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Moline?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my only question is does it matter how long you've been out of the military? Is it for recent retirees who have gone through training, or could you have served 40 years ago and still fall under this statute?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The way it is written is that it does not have a time limit.
Okay. Well,
Emmeline?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I mean, I guess I see the point of the bill. It just seems like if you've had your training 40 years ago, maybe it would make sense to get a certificate again. And then it seems like, well, why should police officers have to get a firearm certificate then? Because they have to stay up to date on their firearm training. So if we're going to start excluding people, I mean, to me, my dad was in the military 40 years ago, but he's also a police officer and a firearms instructor. So, you know, he's up to date on because of his work in law enforcement, not necessarily because he was in the military 40 years ago. So maybe if we're going to be doing this for military members, we could look at expanding it for police officers as well.
Mr. Chair, I'm definitely, let's have the discussion.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lean, if you actually read line 1.9 of the bill, this law took effect for it only applies to those that are required to have the firearm certificate for hunting or those born after December 31st, 1979.
Any other discussion? Any other questions, members? Anyone else in the audience that would like to speak for or against the bill? I think we have some more folks that would like to come up and speak.
Mr. Chair, I do have two more testifiers. Just if they could come up and speak in favor.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Elmer Eichelberg from St. Michael, Minnesota, representing myself. And everything that was stated, I agree with you, so I support the bill 767.
Thank you, sir.
And I am a veteran.
Very good. Next.
Mr. Chair, Alan Lund. I'm representing myself today, Navy veteran, and I would ask for your support of this bill.
Very good. Thank you. Questions, members? Thank you for your testimony. Representative Lucero, anyone else?
No, Mr. Chair.
Please come forward. Mr. Rogers?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chair.
Please state your name again.
Larry Rogers, currently the president of Minnesota Weapons Collectors Association. I'm also a retired police officer with the city of St. Paul and a military veteran. We're in total support of this bill. Anything that reduce any roadblocks or speed bumps for veterans, we're wholeheartedly in support of.
Very good. Thank you. Anyone else in the audience that would like to? Oh, Mr. Representative Johnson. Mr. Rogers, you might want to come back. I believe Mr. Representative Johnson might have a question.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure who can answer. It's just contemplating with myself. I know that part of the basic training for the military, and I believe it's for all branches, is firearms training and qualification. I'm just wondering what happens if somebody is not able to qualify, if they still stay in the military and not be able to, or a different part of the military, would if they didn't qualify in the military, if there's an exemption or something that to make sure that if they come back, if they didn't qualify in the military, that they would have to take this course.
With my knowledge of the topic, on your paperwork that when you get out of the service, your separation paperwork, your DD Form 214 would declare whether you qualified and at what level you qualified.
Representative Johnson,
Mr. Chair, Representative Lucero,
maybe you want to also require that in the bill that it they do qualify, it shows the qualification of the training on their DD-214.
Representative Lucero?
I'm open to the conversation.
Representative Moline?
Well, Mr. Chair, that made me think of another question. Is this your last committee stop, Representative Lucero?
That's correct.
Yes.
I'm just wondering maybe if, I mean, what if somebody had like a dishonorable discharge or something from the military? Would they be included under this? I just wonder if we should fine-tune the language a little bit in that regard.
This is not the end of this conversation for this bill, Representative Moline. It's going to be held over for possible inclusion, and we can discuss it more at another time if we're going to include it. Representative Urizo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This speaks again to the fine-tuning required. You know, you've got plenty of time to do this. The current language just refers to someone who has successfully completed basic training. My mom was in the WAC, and I never heard anything about firearms training. So I don't know at what point women who served in the WAC and the WAVES and the WAF, when that might have changed. So I don't know how old these people would be. If my mother were still around, I doubt that she'd be taking up hunting next year. But that might be something. You might want to just put a clause that since it is on the discharge papers, you know, that you would look to that as your evidence that they actually completed firearm safety training.
And thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Urizo. Yes, and there is a line at the bottom there for giving the commissioner discretion to ask for evidence of that.
Representative Urizo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I don't know why we would need to give the commissioner discretion when you could just ask to see the papers that show it, since you know, we've been informed that those papers do in fact show that, and then you wouldn't have the commissioner having to guess about what that person's circumstances were, and open yourselves up to, you know, discriminating among different people. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Anyone else in the audience that would like to speak for or against the bill, please come forward. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. My name is Stephen Morin. I'm serving as the Vice President for the Minnesota Volunteer Safety Instructors Association. That's who I'm here representing today.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. To save the committee's time, I have a formal prepared statement, a couple of short comments afterwards. I have a copy for the clerk if they'd like that as well. I'm here to express concerns regarding Bill 767, House File 767. The bill proposed an exemption for firearm safety training. Many of my fellow instructors are veterans themselves and share my concerns. We've come forward in years past to express concerns about similar bills. I appreciate the sentiment behind the bill to eliminate the hassle factor for veterans. They've sacrificed so much already for our well-being. I understand the gesture. I also appreciate the trust that we would be placing in them. I feel, however, this proposal is actually doing veterans a disservice by putting them in a different sort of harm's way. In 1947, we had a very high number of people trained in firearm safety, or firearms handling, I should say, courtesy of the United States Armed Forces. If you look at the Minnesota DNR records, we also had a relatively high number per capita of accidents while hunting. Training in the use of a firearm did not clearly transfer over to a safe hunting experience. The state of Minnesota introduced hunter education in the 1950s, and we began to see a downward trend in accidents per capita. In 1979, hunter education was made mandatory for all would-be hunters born after 1980. Those would-be hunters have come of age, and some are now the veterans we're seeking to help today. With this bill, many of those born before 1980 have taken hunter education even though it wasn't required of them. As a result, accidents and fatalities, thanks to hunter education and firearm safety training, have fallen to near record lows. I'm proud to have been part of this program during two fatality-free hunting seasons of 1998 and 2004. I hope to see many more like them. If you were to ask the force commanders today how our servicemen and women are able to successfully do the amazing and often seemingly impossible tasks we ask of them, and some of the covert operations we don't even hear about in newscasts, their commanders might answer with several factors that make it possible. First, they would probably credit the strong heart of freedom's warriors. They might also mention a fundamental devotion to duty and discipline. But lastly, I'm confident they use three more words that sum up my reason for being here today: mission-specific training. Hunter education has evolved to be more than just firearms handling and marksmanship. Today is an introduction to the wildlife, conservation practices, safe game care, ethical concerns, the image of hunters to the non-hunting public, and explains risks and safety hazards, tree stands, for example, that are completely foreign to the world of combat training. It also provides students knowledge of policy decisions and funding facts to make students a sort of spokesman for sportsmen. Hopefully, a student would be able to articulately defend their right to hunt as ultimately benefiting the very species they're hunting, with side benefits to the habitat for all other wildlife and the economic benefits to the people of the state of Minnesota. Past legislation has already exempted the veteran from the field day portion of hunter education. The evolution of safety training curriculum has enabled an interactive online option that any plugged-in, tech-savvy veteran under the age of 35 would be quite literally at home using. I agree a veteran's outdoor survival skills and experiences likely surpass anything I can provide them in the classroom. When I am fortunate enough to have a veteran in a traditional class, I encourage them to share their knowledge and experience. A veteran in a traditional classroom is a valuable asset, a great example and teaching aid for young students. I also am comfortable in veterans not needing to prone out in the gravel and shoot a 22 to prove to me they can hit a target. But one must also admit the possibility exists that someday some may not have held a firearm before or since the day they qualified in basic training, however recent or long ago that may have been. The mental attitudes from soldier to hunter have some overlap, but they are clearly not the same. Minnesota's wildlife game animals are not enemy combatants to be neutralized. They are a renewable, harvestable resource, and with sound ethical game management will thrive for future generations. The hunter's mission is not seek and destroy. The hunter's mission is safe, ethical, positive outdoor experiences. The successful harvest of a game is not a bonus, but the experience itself is the purpose. In the military, a negligent, unsafe, or unethical shot is considered collateral damage. In the hunting community, it's damaged property, a potential tragedy, and a civil or even criminal liability. Between World War I and World War II, U.S. Armed Forces trained millions of sheep, and yet each year, hundreds were killed or injured from hunting accidents. Past legislation, technology, and policy updates have made it easier than ever for adults to get certified in hunter education safety training. And this will allow them to get mission-specific training. Remember, our veterans drill instructors never gave them a free pass. They sucked it in, followed the program, and succeeded. They achieved the goals and earned their place in our respect. For the safety of the veterans themselves and all present and future hunters, I encourage the members of this committee to vote against this bill. If you really want to give them a break, do them a service. Give them a break on their sporting license fees. I'm pretty confident most of us sportsmen would be happy to pick up the difference as a thank you for all we enjoy. Thank you very much for your time.
Questions for Mr. Moran. Representative Corning.
Well, Mr. Chair, members, I condense this all down and they're making a mountain out of a molehill here. I hope we can make this bill work with a few amendments. I mean, we're already letting people buy licenses and hunt that scads of them that were born before 1979 haven't had any training for 30 years. I'm sure we can make an exception for veterans who they go over obstacle courses with their weapons and they What do? We spend a few hours on the range with the kids. I think that the veterans are much more qualified to handle firearms. And true, it isn't about just the firearms itself. It's about hunting. But we're already making huge breaks for these people that were born on a certain date. So I hope we can make this bill work and bring it up again.
Was that a question, Mr. Cornish?
No. I don't think you had a question. Did you, Representative Cornish? No. Any other questions, members? Thank you for your testimony. Anyone else like to speak to the bill? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Rodman Smith, Assistant Director for DNR Enforcement.
Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I won't belabor the point, but the department is opposed to this bill. For many of that, and I just met the gentleman here, we appreciate the military service and the training that our military men and women go through. You know, the legislature and the DNR has worked to remove some of these barriers for our military folks by not having them do the all-day range and field day. They do have to take an online class, but they do also have 2 years worth of hunter apprentice, where if they can't get out and get the firearm safety, still have two full seasons where they can go out and hunt under a hunter apprentice program. But I think the biggest thing here that I wanted to talk to the committee about is that this isn't a Minnesota issue. This is a nationwide issue that's being looked at nationwide. And one of the concerns we have with this bill is that our current firearm safety class is recognized by the International Hunters Education Association and is accepted by other states as proof of successfully completing firearm safety. Our fear is with this amendment or with this bill that potentially what could happen is that we could lose that accreditation, and anybody from Minnesota who wants to go out and hunt out in the western states would not be able to use their Minnesota firearm safety certificate anymore, regardless how they got it, to go hunt those western states. And might have to take, for example, the Wyoming hunter education program. So that's one of the big concerns we have is how this might affect our standing with the International Hunter Education Association by allowing this to happen. So,
any questions, members? Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Well, Representative Lucero, or Representative Detmer, you have some comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. You know, the current law, I'm just looking at it here, the current law exempts those who are currently on active duty. Okay. One thing the committee might look at this bill and say, those who are also currently serving in the National Guard and Reserve components would also qualify, because they're currently serving, they're currently getting training, they're currently having qualifications on the ranges. So maybe that would be one way of making this bill go forward. That's just my suggestion, is that you've got your active duty that are currently exempt, and then maybe those that are currently serving in the Guard and Reserve components would be exempt also. Just a recommendation. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Detmer, and maybe you can work with Representative Lucero on that issue. Any other questions, members? Representative Lucero renews his motion that House File 767 be laid over for possible inclusion. Members, we have one more bill on the list today, House File 814, but Representative Dill had to go to a doctor's appointment today, so we'll possibly take that up at another time. No further business with the committee. Committee adjourned.